Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Two guests today. In seconds, Chris Arnotti will talk about his travels across heartland America. And at the bottom of the hour, James Livingston will denounce work. I apologize for the audio quality of the phone signal in these two interviews. My landline is acting up, producing the weak and sometimes hummy sound. I'm going to have to fix that. First, the writer and photographer Chris Arnotti. He spent many years in Wall Street until he tired of it around the time of the financial crisis. Over the last year, he's been traveling around what Republicans like to call the real America, examining the poverty, despair, and addiction afflicting the heartland. His reports are published in The Guardian, among other places. Chris Arnotti. Okay, so more recently, over the last year or so, you've been just doing a lot of driving around the United States, right? Just give us an idea of your peregrinations.
I spent the last, really, 2 years I put 175,000 miles on my car driving around writing about what I do now is I write about addiction and poverty. And I had spent 3.5 years writing about addiction and poverty in a particular neighborhood in the South Bronx. And then I got my car and decided to see if what I saw in the South Bronx was true across the country. And so I was going into communities that were whatever cliche you want to use to diminish them, left behind, flyover, those communities, towns that people don't usually visit, and I was spending time there and doing a project, what I kind of call poverty and addiction in America. And my goal was to go to 25, 30 different communities across the country and write about them, about the problems they faced. And because of what has happened to our country, it kind of turned into, believe it or not, a project, I guess, on Trump. At some level, it pivoted into me writing about Trump, which I'm not particularly happy to do, but it became the kind of what I was seeing on the ground was a lot of support for him in the white communities I was in.
Now, you mentioned the South Bronx. The South Bronx used to be a symbol, a national symbol of urban despair. It probably has lost some of its iconic status, but you know, that's what the South Bronx means in the popular imagination. But it sounds like you found many South Bronxes across the country.
That's correct. You know, I was kind of shocked, even though I thought I knew that there was a lot of despair in this country, that what I saw in the South Bronx wasn't iconic or wasn't isolated. It was replicated in pretty much any community I went to in the United States. Any large town had a South Bronx in it. And a lot of smaller towns were just smaller versions of the South Bronx. Now, I was intentionally going to places like that. That was my project, but I had no problem finding them. They're everywhere. This project is going to probably look at 30 communities, but I could easily do 3,000 communities. There's just that many out there. And it really is more the norm than the isolated event.
You're in upstate New York now. I imagine you don't have to travel very far to find just the kind of community you're talking about.
That's right. I mean, you know, Newburgh, New York is 15 miles from me. Right after Trump was announced presidency, I went on a 20,000-mile journey, 6 weeks across the country, a big loop around the country. And within that very first day, you know, about 40 miles from my hometown, I ran into my both the first kind of community that was, you know, whatever you want to call that now, a Trump country. And I ran into my first Trump voter. I mean, it grew in crescendo as I was doing this project. It ended up having to be about Trump because that's all I heard in these white communities I was in, you know, and in black communities, though. Although their views were different, that's all people talked about. No matter if I was in a town of despair, in a town with addiction, the dialogue I heard at that time, and it started very early, soon after he announced, was Trump, 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 Trump. And so I started writing about that. I didn't really want to, but that's kind of, you know, if your goal is to write about what you see and you see something, well, you got to write about it.
My friend Jody Dean teaches upstate Hobart and William Smith Colleges in Geneva, New York. I drove up there a couple of years ago. I was struck by the poverty surrounding Geneva. People had roofs that were patched with duct tape. And then, you know, you look at Geneva itself, the college town, the college students themselves, pretty affluent. The college town looks pretty affluent and comfortable, but, you know, you drive 5 miles out of town and you're in the midst of absolute despair. And Jody told me that somewhat before the election, she saw a sign on somebody's lawn, "Deplorable Lives Matter." How did that remark about the deplorables, how did that play in the communities you visited?
People owned it. People took it and owned it and took it as a kind of a badge of honor that somebody who they didn't respect. To them, what they had always felt was implicit, made explicit, the idea that they were not valued, they were looked down upon. The political elite didn't really care for them, only viewed them as deplorables. And so it became a kind of a badge of honor, like you know, your friend saw. I saw people kind of happily touting, "Look, I'm a deplorable." But, you know, long before that moment, you heard a lot of, if you get out of your bubble, and, you know, I use a cliche bubble because I think people really do. I think it's true that there's a lot of the elite media, a lot of us, including myself, I call us front row kids, people who have elite educations and, you know, have good jobs and have careers that take us all around the world. When you get beyond where we live and who we talk to, is to see an entirely different America, one in which there isn't a lot of hope. There's a feeling that your children are not going to have a life you had. They're going to have a life worse than you had. And that's a huge change, the idea that going forward, things are not going to be good. And then you layer on top of that the sense that nobody cares about you. Nobody cares about that. You couldn't have created a better recipe for kind of angry populist politics to enter into that.
Matt Iglesias, who's a writer I don't always agree with, wrote a piece shortly after the election in which he said it's not very helpful to think about the Trump voter. And there are at least three kinds he could enumerate. One was just a traditional Republican who voted for Trump because for traditional Republican reasons, tax cuts, deregulation. Then the second type would be, you know, real hardcore xenophobes, racists, you know, the Trump voter of caricature. And the third is a floating population of people who are just feel left behind, discontented, and voted for Trump in the hope that, you know, he might do something, might shake things up. Now, you're talking about the third kind of Trump voter, right, not the first two.
Yeah, but I would also argue that I don't agree with Matt on that. I think that's partly true, but I think the last two camps, I think the second camp is lesser of importance than the last, you know, the xenophobic, the hardcore racists. I mean, I think that's a small segment of what's going on, and I think it diffuses into the third camp, which is, you know, I call them the white working class voters, the people who feel left behind. I think that third camp, I would say there's basically two. They're kind of the left behind voters, and then there's traditional GOP voters, and I look at how they drove this election by kind of looking at the change relative to 2012, the arrow map, the map of how did it vote relative to Romney. And the difference in this election relative to Romney are that third camp. That third camp came out and voted. That third camp came out and voted in large numbers, and they voted in large numbers in electorally important places. They're the ones, the white working class, that I think swung this election the way it swung. Trump would not have been elected if a lot of the GOP base, the kind of suburban mom who always votes, or the banker who votes for tax cuts, didn't vote for Republicans. But Trump really won because the white working class swung to him and came out in numbers that were unprecedented.
Now, there are a lot of counties that went for Obama at least once, sometimes twice, that went for Trump this time around. Did you find that sort of thing?
Yeah, I call them the OOT counties. I've gone to five of those, six of those, seven of those in the last 6 months. Calhoun County, Michigan, the county where Lewiston, Maine is in, the county where Youngstown, Ohio is in, and the county where Portsmouth, Ohio is in. And Dubuque, Iowa. I've gone to those particular counties. That's where I focus my look at what happened in those counties and why they swung to Trump and why he won the election is because in these particular counties you had just enough white working class people come out, but you also had just enough minorities not come out. So, you know, relative to 2012, 8% or 7% of the minority voters just didn't come out this time. And an additional 5% of the white working class did come out, and those two combined was just enough to push Trump over in these particular places.
So what was it about Trump that appealed to these people, that made them vote and made them hope?
He was talking to them viscerally. I mean, you know, all these places, there are two kind of there are two or three things that these places all have in common. These counties have swung from Obama to Trump. One is they don't have an elite educational institution. They don't have a college in their town. They have a college, but it might be a community college or a smaller state school. They've lost a lot of jobs over the last few decades from manufacturing that has gone. Youngstown's lost a lot of steel mills. Portsmouth has lost a lot of manufacturing. Battle Creek, Michigan, which is in Calhoun County, lost a lot of its cereal factories. In each of these towns, it used to be a pathway for the citizens, white and black, that you just left high school and you went into the factory and you had a 30-year career. That is gone now. And that loss of kind of stability of just walking out of high school into a factory has changed not only the prospects for jobs, but it's completely changed the town. The town's social network has fallen apart. The downtowns are gone. They're emptied of stores. And in their absence has come a lot of drugs and a lot of despair. So the whole fabric of the towns are just changed, and for the worse. And so... so many times they've heard politicians come in and say, well, we're going to fix this, and yet it continues. And, a lot of them gave a chance on Obama and the hope and change, and neither came. And so they're like, especially at that point, the white citizen says, well, I'm done. I'm done betting on these people who come in and say, we're going to do this for you. Here's this guy coming in basically saying, I'm going to kick everything over. Why not? Let's give it a shot. Because what we've been doing for the last, 25 years, my trust in these people who say they're going to fix it, they haven't done it. They haven't fixed it. My town still is decaying. And so it was just a matter of, I played the short odds so many times, and they've burned me, so now I'm going to play the long odds. I keep losing at checkers. I'm going to knock the board over. It was just, to be blunt, a big you.
I'm speaking with the writer and photographer, Chris Arnotti. Your piece about Youngstown in The Guardian was interesting because Youngstown is much more diverse than people's sense of what the Heartland Trump voter is all about. And there's a fairly large number of black people there and even a mosque and Muslims who surprisingly didn't hate Trump so much. What did you find in Youngstown?
I found that kind of combination. I found if you were a white working class guy and you're angry, you voted. You came out and voted, and in some cases you might have went, and women, you went for Trump. You might have voted for Obama, but you went for Trump, and you got to the poll. You actually got out and you voted. And if you were a frustrated black, you might not have voted. It was just a sliver of enough to swing Youngstown, almost. It almost went for Trump after having gone for Obama like 16% year before. It almost, just Trump lost it by 1%, I think. But it was just the combination. It was a sense of despair, a sense of frustration. And how that despair and frustration was rendered was a function of your race. If you were white, you saw Trump and he was talking to you. He was signaling things to you as a white guy that, some of them very ugly things that work for you. And if you were a black guy, you saw Trump, you didn't like him, but you didn't really like Hillary either, so you just didn't go out and vote. The combination of those things at the margin almost swung Youngstown. And when I went to the mosque, Youngstown does have a mosque, and it's a pretty big mosque, and I attended Friday service, prayer service, and the first person I ran into was a Trump voter, Middle Eastern descent. I didn't run into a lot more Trump voters in the mosque, but I found a few, and I remember the first gentleman who ran into me, Middle Eastern descent, at the mosque, been in Youngstown for 30 years. He's like, yeah, I voted for Trump. He's like, look, I'm not dumb. This town is falling apart. We need a change.
Now, we're seeing a bunch of liberals looking with, I don't want to say glee, at the prospect of Trump voters being denied their health insurance, and losing the legal services corporation that may have saved them from foreclosure. A real contempt for these people. They're getting what they deserve. They voted for Trump, and now they're going to get kicked in the ass. What do you think of that reaction?
I'm an old school liberal. I think you give everything context, and you never demean any group. If you demean any group as... especially a group that has less power than you do, less wealth than you do, less opportunity than you do, as as deserving what they get of being dumb, anything atavistic, lazy, dumb, weak. I think that's just absolutely the wrong way to go about it. You look at things in the context. You look at things in a socioeconomic context, and you look at decisions made in a socioeconomic context, and you certainly don't wish harm on any group in aggregate. I mean, that's just that is deplorable to think that view, that any one group is deserving of ill health or deserving of a lesser life than you. I think that attitude, I don't want to assign too much importance to a few pundits who have taken that view, but I think that attitude, you know, certainly is symbolic of a lot of less extreme attitudes amongst what I would call the liberal elite and the conservative elite as well, of the sense that voters are beneath them and voters are uninformed and don't deserve their smart policies. And it's a detachment between the realities of the working class life and policy that I think has doomed a lot of the Democratic Party to electoral losses. If you're really kind of gleeful, people dying of heroin addiction, then I think you just need to really take a step back and ask, you know, why are you doing this as either a pundit or a politician, and reassess your values.
But a lot of Democrats explain the Trump vote by saying, you know, they're all, well, the deplorables remark, they're all just a bunch of hateful racists and xenophobes. What about the racism and xenophobia? How much of that did you hear? How deep did it run? How hostile was it?
I grew up in a small southern town that was divided by a railroad track in the 60s and 70s. NAACP meeting were held in my house because churches were scared of being burned down at the time. My father's car was, while my father was in it, was shot at because of his views on civil rights. I've been at the fringes of a lot of ugly stuff, nothing compared to what minorities in my town went through, nothing at all compared to what they faced. I'm not in denial that there's a lot of ugly racist politics in our country and that the GOP has embraced those tactics to get where it is these days. But I also don't think that simply looking at racism and assigning privilege and white privilege to every white person and every, especially working class, is either fair or good politics. I think there's a big difference between racism and unacknowledged privilege. White working class comes with a lot of unacknowledged privilege that allows them to overlook ugly policies, just like me not being Yemeni allows me to overlook Obama's drone policies when I voted for Obama. So I think there's a big, big difference between outright bigotry and racism and unacknowledged white privilege. And I think you can address the unacknowledged white privilege without yelling racism. And I think doing so is A, more realistic and more true, and also I think far better politically in terms of having a chance to bring an economic message into these communities.
Have you had a chance to talk to any Trump voters since he staffed his administration with, you know, very pretty traditional conservatives in some areas and Goldman Sachs alums, even more than I think Bush and Obama combined? Did they feel any sense of betrayal, or is it too soon to tell?
Where they feel the betrayal is on the health care. I think we, myself, you, people on Twitter and the media tend to forget how much we focus on politics and how little other people focus on politics. Look, people's lives are more complicated than ours. Often they got a lot of things going on, and caring about what the presidential spokesman says on day two or on Tuesday is not one of those. But health care is something that is visceral and a real issue. And where I've heard the first signs of people looking at Trump and maybe realizing they got scammed, and look, I believe they got scammed, is on health care, where I think these are real changes and these are real policy changes that will impact their lives, their families' lives, their congregants' lives, people in their communities' lives, and in a negative way. And I think you have to And I think Trump is making a massive mistake on, political mistake on health care, not just because I disagree with his changes, but simply because I think if I was his political advisor, I would tell him, you're going to lose a lot of votes because of this.
Where can they go then? If you mentioned the sense that all the people who voted for Obama buying the Hope and Change, now they bought another version of Hope and Change. Where can they go next?
We'll see what the Democrats offer up in 2018, 2020. But really, what they'll look, I mean, they just won't vote, right? They just won't go out. You know, people forget that there's a third choice, which is not voting. And that third choice was exercised by a lot of Democrats. Enough Democrats or enough independents, minorities, young, that it swung the election to Trump. And I think, you know, if you were to replay the election today, Trump, I believe, would lose electorally as well as in the popular vote, because I think a lot of his voters just wouldn't go to the, just wouldn't vote. The additional turnout just wouldn't happen. And the turnout amongst the young and the minorities and the Democrat base would be supersized this time. So I think, you know, you would have had a popular vote and electoral vote win for Hillary if you were to rerun the election today.
And finally, you planning to put some more miles in the car?
Yeah, I'm going to do another. I got another 6 months of traveling, then I'm done. I'm actually just writing now about a black working class town that didn't vote for Trump, Gary, Indiana, where there's just as much despair, but there's not any Trump love. I'm doing a project on refugees, and then I'm going to the West Coast for 2 months of looking at communities on the West Coast, and then I'm done. Then I'll have 260,000 miles in my car, and if my car survives by then.
That was Chris Arnotti, a former bond trader turned photographer and writer. You can find his reports in The Guardian. Arnade is how you spell his name. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. Some of Surreal Chemists by Stereolab, the cowering mendacity of bourgeois Christian civilization indeed. Next, James Livingston. He was last in this show in 2012 discussing his book Against Thrift. Now he's out with a small volume called No More Work, Why Full Employment is a Bad Idea, published last October by the University of North Carolina Press. The original title involved an obscenity, the one beginning with an F, which we're not allowed to say on the air, but his publisher was too discreet to put that version on the cover. When he's not writing provocative books, Livingston teaches at Rutgers. What is this work that you want no more of, exactly?
The kind that is coerced, the kind that produces, shall we say, it presupposes and also produces exploitation, the kind that makes us go to jobs that are no longer necessary, the kind that makes us produce goods that are no longer valuable, the kind that keeps us from deciding what we want to be when we grow up. That is to say, the kind of jobs that keep us from the leisure time that we all have earned and deserve. So I guess that covers a whole lot of jobs, a whole lot of occupations. We don't have to work as hard as we do, but we keep doing it. So my question in the book was, all right, why is that? What's going on here? Quite apart from you have to work to make a living, because that part of the equation in the job market has fallen apart. You know, everybody works, but nobody can actually piece together a living anymore. The book really is like a way of asking ourselves, why is it that we want to work, and what could we do to pry ourselves apart from that desire?
Now, I'm sure you've heard the objection, here you are, you know, you teach, you seem to like teaching, you write books, so you really don't live your example. What do you say to that?
I say, fuck you. I don't know. Where am I going to go with that? I work hard, okay? When I teach, I'm working hard. But I don't teach that often. I teach 2 days a week. That's the luxury of the teaching schedule at Rutgers, where I teach. But when I'm not doing that kind of work, I'm sitting at a keyboard and tapping away, typing, as you know, but as you do as well. So I'm not saying we all need to have that kind of drive or that kind of ambition or that kind of purpose. I don't want everybody to have some almost fetishistic attachment to writing like I do. That's not the point. The point is to let people decide what they want to be. I mean, to give them enough time to themselves to decide for themselves what they're going to do for the next few hours or for the next few days. That's really the point. Yeah, am I in the parlance of today? Am I privileged? Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I have a tenured job at Rutgers University. So what? I'm speaking for myself, who cannot retire because retirement account is not sufficient. But I'm also speaking, I think, for the people who can't make ends meet, who work their asses off, but don't have a living wage.
Well, it seems that you have it in more for the job than work.
Yeah, I guess, you know, what we used to call alienated labor. Sure. Yeah. The way that us academic types approach work is typically to say, okay, this is alienated labor, and this is really bad for us, and what do we do about it? Most of my colleagues, I would guess, until very recently, actually, with the exception now becoming the rule, like Kathy Weeks, would say, well, you know, what we need to do is make work meaningful. And to me, that's a dead end. That's going back to the Marx of 1842, 43, 44, something like that. And I'm just not interested in that. I think it's much more interesting to think about what it would mean after work, like when work is not something that you have to do every day for 8 hours a day. And maybe that's what you're getting at when you differentiate the job from work. I don't know. I think, however, now that I think of it, I think the assumption embedded in your question, the job versus work, is the same kind of distinction that Hannah Arendt tried to make in The Human Condition, the great, great book of 1958, the Meditation on Marx, the Meditation on Work, where she made the distinction between work, real work, meaningful work, and labor, the spastic movement of people who weren't thinking and creating while they were on the job. They were just a set of metabolisms.
Well, it's like a sculptor versus Charlie Chaplin in the assembly line.
Yeah, okay, sure. And Chaplin, I think, shared in exactly that, you know, the kind of distinction is, yeah. And to me, the hell with meaningful work, too. We can't all get there, but at least let us make some choices. I mean, how many people do you know? I know a lot who, if given the opportunity, if they just didn't have to work 8 hours, 10 hours, 12 hours a day, they'd be doing interesting stuff. But that would be up to them, not to me. That's the kind of choice I think we—that is to say, us Americans for the time being, and the rest of the world pretty soon—are in a position to make, and not for their own good. That's not the point. The point is that we've reached a stage of civilization where this is eminently possible and quite necessary as well, if we're not going to drive each other crazy and produce, you know, way too many things that we don't want or need.
You give the example of downloading things for free, the costless reproduction of intellectual property products. Yet those all depend upon huge infrastructures of computer servers and fiber optics and lots of electricity powered by typically fossil fuels. So this theoretical abundance we have nonetheless depends upon this compulsion to work, doesn't it?
Yeah. But then the question becomes, where does the compulsion to work come from? Now, you could say, as Marx actually, he didn't say this, you could say the compulsion to work is externally imposed. that because the market power or the social power of money and capital is greater than the social power of the proletarian, that the proletarian is compelled to work. Or you could say with Freud that the compulsion to work is something that it is an inherent, intrinsic part of human nature. I'm more inclined to the Freudian version of it, but I think Marx was at least ambiguous enough to recognize it. So, now, I guess the question for you would be then, all right, if that's all true, if all this infrastructure, these servers and these towers and this electricity are going into the creation and the distribution of information that seems to us to be free of charge, how come? What happened here? Why is all this infrastructure suddenly losing or has lost its value? That would be my question. And that's why I try to end on an apocalyptic note of, we're living through the perfection of capitalism. We're living through the end of capitalism because it's the perfection of capitalism.
These servers are owned and run by the likes of Google and Amazon and Apple, who are making money on these things. So I don't see that law has been repealed yet.
I don't either. I'm not saying nobody's making money. I'm saying that you and I can get information for free. Why is that? If these people are making money, these corporations. I don't want to go down that road, but yes. How come? What has happened here? And it seems to me that one of the things that's happened here is that the people who actually produce and provide the information, not the corporations that distribute it, the people who produce and provide the information, their labor has become, it is tending towards zero. You know, the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist from San Jose, has to get out of journalism because he can't make a living doing it. Adjunct professors now dominate my profession. The teaching of whatever, social sciences, history, humanities, wherever you want to go. How come? Why is the value of this labor time so close to zero? I know a lot of people, a lot of people that teach 11 courses a year, like four load semester to semester, and then they teach three sessions in the summer. These are adjunct professors, and they're making roughly $30,000 a year, and there's no benefits attached, and there's no pension fund involved either. Now, what does that tell us about the value of intellectual work? I mean, quite apart from the money that Google and Apple and all these people are making. Again, sorry, not people, corporations.
Corporations are people, too.
Well, they certainly are now. Yes. In view of Citizens United, and in the view of one of my students who's doing an honors thesis, Bilotti versus First National Bank of Boston is really the key. That's a 1978 decision that opened the door to the Citizens United decision. I think he's right.
Since we're intellectuals and writers, we're used to looking at these fields because they're very familiar to us, but the world of food provision, people make clothes, people make pharmaceuticals. I mean, this has not yet been revolutionized into the same kind of costlessness of intellectual production it seems to be tending.
Food? What do you say, food?
Yeah, food, clothing, all the necessities of life and the baubles as well, the gadgets that make everything possible.
I don't know about that. It seems to me that the consistent trend from the early 20th century into our own time is that the cost of food, at least its proportion of familial budgets, has been declining. I think clothing you can observe the same trends there. Now, does that mean that we've outsourced these the production of these things? Yeah. But I don't think you can say because it's outsourced, that's why the value of the labor time involved is declining. It's not simply that. I'm not sure I understand the import of your question. I mean, yeah, food, clothing, shelter, but, jobs have been displaced in all three places, and the costs of producing all three have also declined. So maybe, you know, maybe you could explain what the...
Who will provide the necessities of life without the compulsion to work?
Well, that reminds me of a question that you and I have heard before. Who's going to pick up the garbage after the revolution? I don't think that's a problem. I'll tell you why. My students get kind of agitated and sometimes even angry when I lay out this argument for a universal basic income and for the end of work. That is to say, enough already, let's stop. And what they say is that, well, what happens to our initiative? What happens to our drive to excel or to succeed? What if I want to do a startup? And my response is, well, with a universal basic income of, you know, this is just an arbitrary sum of, say, $40,000, you know, fine. You know, if you want to do a startup, take the $40,000 and invest it in your own company. Do what you want. You know, after you're done with your $40,000 UBI, that seems to me another issue. Now, to go back to the compulsion to work, I know how thoroughly Freudian you are, so I can speak this way.
Feel free. We're 10 feet away from the complete works of Freud here.
I know. I've seen them. Look, you know, the compulsion to work is really the urge to freedom. That is to try to extricate ourselves from the domination of objects and the external world. What we're trying to do is, if you want to go back to Sandor Berenzi, it's to reproduce the condition of infantile omnipotence. So the compulsion to work is just a way for us to express our ineradicable desire for freedom. We want to be free of external constraint, but also external determinants. That's why the compulsion to work is so powerful, because we all want to be free. All right, so, but work at this stage of civilization has now made us, it seems to me, unfree, and we don't have to observe its psychological or its social protocols anymore. And we can talk about why that is, too. So that compulsion to work can be transferred, it seems to me, to other spheres, other domains of our life. I mean, if we can say, you know what, you don't have to work these 8 hours a day, and you're still going to have an income, then people, you know, that compulsion to work, that compulsion to be free, can take other, perhaps less strenuous, perhaps less productive, perhaps less neurotic forms than it does under this system that we call capitalism. I'm not sure that I'm actually answering your question, but that's, you know, the compulsion to work is, you know, to me is both, you know, a symptom and attempted cure of what ails us.
I'm speaking with James Livingston, who teaches at Rutgers and is the author of No More Work, Why Full Employment is a Bad Idea, published by the University of North Carolina Press. All right, let's move on to another vulgar empirical question here. A lot of your argument seems to depend on the idea that work is disappearing, that the job just has disappeared, we're not generating employment. In the United States, that's just not true. We've generated about 10 million new jobs since the post-recession low. Productivity growth is pretty close to zero in the U.S. now. So, you know, the robots are not taking our jobs, at least by the conventional economic statistics. Does that change your argument at all?
I don't think so. I mean, because the argument is twofold. The argument has two dimensions, I think. One is that I am reliant on studies by MIT and Oxford economists and many others as well, that most of the job classifications that we now use to characterize and to study the labor force will disappear under the hammers of computerization by, say, 2025, 47%, according to the Oxford study. So, you know, I rely on those statistics, yes, to talk about the end of work, shall we say. Yeah, but the other dimension of it is, even with, you know, what did you say, 10 million jobs?
10 million from the post-recession low, yeah.
Right, okay, we're now under 5% unemployment, right? What does the job market look like, and what does income inequality look like? the job market still looks like it looked in 2005. That is to say, the relationship between effort and reward, work and income, is still illegible and unjustifiable. That is to say, 25% of employed adults in this country are at or below the poverty line. 40 to 50% of them, employed adults, are eligible for food stamps. Labor force participation rates amongst mature adults who are male are stagnant or falling. Life expectancy is falling amongst white people, white men particularly, in the South because of the lack of jobs. So, yeah, I think, yeah, you can say 10 million jobs have been created, but the jobs that have been created are really, really jobs. They're the kind of contingent, low-paying jobs that are the next generation, you know, my students, for example, have come to expect as if that's their lot, and their parents have come to accept it as well. So, yeah, I mean, that's the paradox that I would like to emphasize, is that, yeah, we've created all these jobs, and what has happened to the income shares in this country? Not a thing. In fact, income inequality has probably been deepening, sharpening since 2008. So, you know, since the recovery, the official recovery, as the NBER would say,
You know, I don't disagree with any of that, but this reminds me of this fight I used to have around Jeremy Rifkin and Stanley Aronowitz's work about 15 years ago. You know, I would love more leisure and less compulsion, but I just am suspicious of any arguments that claim that automation is going to make it happen. It's going to happen politically, not because of any kind of technological intervention.
Okay, I think I understand what you're getting at here. I have two responses. First, I would agree with you that it's a political prospect and a political project. I don't have any doubt of that, that we're going to have to muster the will to say enough already. Okay, that's one thing. The other thing is that, you know, I don't think Rifkin ever even believed that automation would automatically, shall we say, create a workless America. I don't know about Stanley. Stanley I can never figure out anyway, so don't tell him I said that. But the difference in our time, I believe, from the Malthusian precedent, that is, you know, the Malthusians have always said, well, you know, oh my God, you know, the thing is ending. You know, capitalism is over, or will be very soon, and they were always proved wrong because demand for labor increased, because there were new sectors, new innovative moments in the development of capitalism. I think I'm not a Malthusian in that sense. My issue here, I guess there's two ways to put it. First, once upon a time, when labor was displaced from goods production through labor-saving machinery, there were lots of people who had to build the machinery, so that labor-saving machinery was, you know, that, yeah, that was certainly true. But labor demand for labor in the aggregate at the macro level increased because, again, somebody had to build the machines. The other way to look at it would be to look at investment, net investment. You and I have talked about this a little bit anyway.
Yeah, we talked about this in your thrift book.
Yeah. Net investment since 1919 has been atrophying. That is to say, you know, profits have become more and more and more pointless. So it's not just a question of automation. It's a question of what are we going to do with all the surplus? Look at what the banks are sitting on. Look what the corporations are sitting on. Apple, right? They don't have to invest to increase their output or to create demand for their products. All they have to do is produce them. And they can produce them at less and less and less cost, because the value of the labor that goes into these things is less and less. So, I mean, I agree with you. It's not an automatic. It's not, you know, it's not a some sort of teleological process by which automation creates, you know, this workless, jobless, post-capitalist future. It is a political prospect, but we have to look at the investment side of this if we're ever going to figure it out. And nobody seems to want to do that, except maybe you and me. I don't know.
I want to conclude on something where we're in hearty agreement upon the universal basic income. And you unearthed the time capsule in which Richard Nixon, at one point, with the assistance of guys named Cheney and Rumsfeld, were pushing this idea. 47 years later, the UBI has become somewhat fashionable again. So just lay out what your idea of a UBI is, and wouldn't it destroy our willingness to get out of bed in the morning?
Well, I'll work backward. I don't know if it would destroy our willingness to get out of bed in the morning, but as you just mentioned, there's empirical evidence to suggest that it would not. In other words, we don't have to do a thought experiment. We don't have to hypothesize about the effect of these things, about, you know, of income supplements or income guarantees. We don't have to guess. We can tell from the studies that were conducted from 1968 until 1981. Throughout the North American continent, in Canada as well as the United States, covering roughly 6,000 families, we know what happens. To go back to what you were saying, is this compulsion to work ever going to disappear? People want to work. People will go to work. It's not going to corrode their moral fiber, perhaps in part because they know that if they don't go to work, that moral fiber will decay. I don't know. But I don't think that those of us who are in favor of UBI should be worried about what will happen when it's installed. On the grounds of empirical evidence, those studies carried out between 68 and 81, but also on the grounds that we're not in a position to judge what people want to do with their leisure time. That's what I think the fundamental flaw in Skidelsky's book is. You know, that they're worried about idleness as opposed to the productive use of leisure. To me, I don't want to be the person who says this is the correct use of your time, and that is not that's not up to us. That's not up to anybody. To tell you the truth.
Well, that's just elitist disdain for the slobby masses, isn't it?
Yeah. Although I the Skidelskys are just it's a marvelous book. It's a wonderful, wonderful book, and. But, you know, they still worry in this creeping Puritan way about, like, oh, well, geez, you know, we have to educate people to use their leisure properly. Well, I don't think I'm in a position to educate anybody to use their leisure properly. Let them play video games. Who cares? That's not up to me.
And finally, you've mentioned that you get a lot of resistance when you lay out this argument from your students. I'm sure you get it from people you talk to, you know, outside the classroom. You would think it would be very appealing, this post-work free money ideal. But why is it such, seem, you know, what, 10, 15 years ago, no one thought we could have gay marriage and legal marijuana. So, you know, anything can happen. But it does seem like a non-starter politically. Why do you suppose that is?
People have asked me this, like, you know, if on April 17th, 1970, the House passes this bill at the urging of Rumsfeld and Cheney, what happened to it? How did it disappear so quickly? And I don't have an answer. I don't have a good answer, to tell you the truth. I think the explosions, or implosions, I should say, of the 1970s account for some of it, and I think Reagan's rise does as well. All I can say is I don't know. But I do know that something else is happening, and that is everybody is talking about this. I'm just like, I'm one of, like, what, dozens of people who are talking about a UBI. I mean, you know, from Kathy Weeks to Peter Fraze to Seth Ackerman and everybody else at Jacobin. Paul Mason, I am told, is on this trail, too. I mean,
well, Silicon Valley people, too.
Yes, exactly. So it's in that sense, you might even say that it's a cross-class intellectual movement. And that, to me, is very promising. I don't care who talks about it. I just want us to be able to talk about it.
Well, libertarians want to end the welfare state, and the leftists want to give the working class free money, so it seems like we could have a win-win here.
Yeah. And one of the questions I got, I was at this conference, and I gave this talk with the F word, at the end of it, one guy says, well, it sounds to me like you're making a case for reparations. And I said, well, yeah, you know, that sounds perfectly reasonable to me. Yeah. So So, yeah, it has so many, I think, echoes and the implications that I think we're right to be worried, but I think we're also right to say to ourselves, you know, yeah, now's the time to talk about it. Now's the time. There isn't any reason not to. But, you know, on the other hand, there's Paul Ryan, and then there's the orange ones.
That was James Livingston, a professor of history at Rutgers and author of No More Work from the University of North Carolina Press. I sometimes feel guilty about getting the last word in on my interviewees, but it seemed like Jim kept missing my point about how all the things that make our lives possible are produced by scores of millions of workers, and if the no-work thing were widely adopted, we would have nowhere to sit, nothing to eat, nothing to wear, no hospitals if we got sick, and no way of communicating with each other. He's so focused on the consumption side, the downloadable MP3s, the declining cost of food and clothing, that he misses the production side that makes it all possible. I'm all for less toil, but I've yet to hear any of these refusal of work people make a convincing case for how we would get from one day to the next without the goods and services that sustain life. A universal basic income would be worthless. Money itself would be worthless if there was nothing to buy with it. And sorry, I was wrong about the number of new jobs created in the U.S. since the post-recession low in 2010. It's 16 million, not 10 million. Yes, many of these new jobs are crappy, but it's just wrong to say that jobs are disappearing. There are studies saying that jobs will disappear over the next decade. Maybe they will. But I recall hearing similar things in the late 1990s, and in fact, we've been hearing similar things since at least the 1890s. Maybe it's different this time. But history is against us on that one. Yes, we could make a far more humane society than the one we have, but it's generally more helpful to start by seeing the world as it is than as we want it to be. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of Johnny Paycheck's classic commentary on work. Till next week, bye.
Take this job and shove it. I ain't working here no more. A woman done left and took all the reason I was working for. You better not try to stand in my way as I'm walking out the door. Take this job and shove it. I ain't working here no more. I've been working in this factory for now 15 years. All this time I watched my woman drowning in a pool of tears. And I've seen a lot of good folk die, had a lot of bills to pay. I'd give the shirt right off of my back if I had the guts to say.